Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. So if you can't catch the show live, you can download it or simply use our free podcast player, which is available on our website at www.theorganicview.com. If you'd like to connect with us, please post a question on our wall on Facebook or send me a tweet at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@theorganicview.com. Today's show is sponsored by MyMumble.com, one of the leading voice chat service providers with locations all over the world. MyMumble offers free 5-seat voice chat service for life, as well as higher capacity plans for any group that requires a secure environment for confidential communication. Listeners of The Organic View can receive 15% off on monthly recurring power servers by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. For more promotional offers, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. On today's show, Dr. Dave Golson, Professor of Bumblebee Ecology and Conservation at the University of Sussex, will talk about his reanalysis of a fair field study, which has been getting quite a bit of attention, especially by pro-neonicotinoid supporters. But first, I'd like to welcome to the show my special guest co-host, Colorado beekeeper Mr. Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, Joan, and hello, Dr. Golson.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Dr. Golson. So nice to have you back on the show, Professor.
That's my pleasure.
Professor, could you please share a little bit about yourself for our listeners who are not familiar with your work?
I've been studying bees, mainly wild bees, bumblebees in particular, for about 20 years or so. I've written books on them. I've written lots of papers. But I have a new book coming out in the United States called The Buzz in the Meadow next month. So that's quite exciting, which is all about the importance of insects generally, and also where it describes my attempts to recreate a wildflower meadow for bees in a rural part of France.
Well, I look forward to having you come back on the show if you can make some time to talk about the book. I know that your work is very popular, especially with my listeners and people actually all over the world. You're just such a greatly admired researcher as well as a lover of nature. So I hope to have you back very soon.
I'm sure I'd be more than happy to come back soon.
Professor, the paper that you recently published is titled Neonicotinoids Impact Bumblebee Colony Fitness in the Field, a reanalysis of the UK's Food and Environment Research Agency 2012 experiment. What prompted you to do this?
I could have come up with a snappier title with hindsight, couldn't I? So it's quite an interesting kind of story, this, and I'll try and keep it reasonably short. But what the Food and Environment Research Agency is a kind of research wing of the UK government. And back in 2012, my own research group published a paper on the effects of neonics on bumblebee colonies, which seemed to show that they were having a really dramatic impact. We found 85% drop in queen production when we exposed them to field realistic doses of imidacloprid. And almost immediately after that was published, the UK government asked FERA, this agency, to basically repeat our experiment, more or less, but to do one thing slightly differently. So we dosed the bees in the lab and then put them outside so that we could control the dose. They tried to expose the bees in the field by putting them next to either treated or untreated fields of canola. And so they did this experiment. They put their bumblebee nests out in the spring of 2012 next to these different fields. And the experiment went kind of badly wrong in one sense, which is that their control bees, when they looked at the food stores that were in the nests, the food the bees had brought back, they found that almost all their control nests were full of neonics. In fact, many of them have more neonics in them than the nests that were supposed to have been exposed to neonics. So basically their controls were gone. And I mean, as a side point, that does illustrate that you know, wherever you put bee nests in the British landscape, they are being exposed to neonics, whether you put them near a field that's been treated or a long way away from it, which is what they've done for their control. Anyway, they wrote this study up, and they did some rather complicated analyses. It seems very complicated and quite hard to understand analyses. And they concluded that their study showed that these pesticides had no impact on bees. And they didn't try and publish this in a peer-reviewed journal, as you might expect. That would be the normal thing to do with a scientific study. And then it would go through a peer-reviewed process. It would be, you know, checked over independently by other scientists before it got published. They didn't do any of that. Rather surprisingly, they just slapped it on the internet, and they just put this report on the DEFRA website. And then the UK government cited it as one of the key pieces of evidence that justified their voting against the European moratorium on neonics, which thankfully was passed anyway, because a large majority of European countries voted for it, but the British government voted against. And as I say, they used this bumblebee study from FERA as one of their pieces of evidence to justify that vote. I was aware of this study from fairly early on. I was asked to comment on it before it was put on the internet, before it was made public. And I played around with the data and looked at it in a slightly different way. If you look at the amount of pesticide in the individual nests and relate that to how well the nests then performed, how well they grew and how many new queen bees they produced at the end of the year, actually you find a really strong negative relationship. Basically, the nests that happen to feed in the wrong place, to pick up more pesticides in their food, did really badly. And there's a very strong statistical relationship between the dose the nests receive and how well they then did. So it's completely the opposite of what the study claimed it showed. So when the reported study online says that they found really no significant effects, no negative effect of pesticides on bees, actually they found completely the opposite. Their own data show quite clearly that there is a strong negative effect. And when I saw them put this online, I must admit I was a little bit indignant, because I had already pointed out to them what their data actually showed. And it seems strange that as far as I could see, they seemed to be misinterpreting their own data. And of course, it hadn't been through peer review, so nobody else had a chance to check on this.
Dr. Goulson, as I recall, the government scientist who was responsible for that work was Dr. Helen Thompson, and I also recall that she left the government shortly after this information was released. What has become of her?
So the study was done in 2012. It was made public in the winter of 2013, so roughly 2 years ago now. And then shortly afterwards, that in July 2013, so a few months after the study was made public, she jumped ship and was suddenly working for Syngenta, and I believe she still works for Syngenta, who of course are one of the main manufacturers in Europe of neonics.
I think it's puzzling to those of us out here in the hinterland, all of this scientific controversy, because it appears to us that this is not science, it's salesmanship, and it's carefully managed to present a certain viewpoint. And neonicotinoids are at the lead of that story, and there's a lot of background intrigue that's going on here. You know, why would the UK government misconstrue a study like this? What would motivate them to do such a thing? I don't expect you to answer that Dr. Goulson. I guess I'm just commenting on my concern as a citizen. It looks to me as if we are having a massive poisoning of the environment, and we're faced with an endless number of excuses and distortions of science. I guess I have a question for the scientific community. Were I a scientist, the misuse of science, as I see it, would be an embarrassment, and yet we find few scientists like yourself who are speaking out. Can you shed a little light on that for us lay people?
I wish I could. I find government policy hard to understand. Of course, politicians have other things on their mind other than just the science. One problem we certainly have in the UK is that our politicians are none of them scientists, none of them really, almost no politicians in Britain have done a science degree, which doesn't help. But it does seem to me that basically in the UK, the government seems to choose the policy and then find the science to support it rather than the other way around, which is obviously pretty depressing and disappointing from my perspective, and you kind of wonder why you're bothering. But that, you know, that's why I thought it was important to try and put the record straight on this particular study, which was being touted as showing one thing. And, you know, if you're a member of the public, how do you know what to believe when you're being told a set of data shows a certain thing? You know, unless you've spent years as a scientist and studied statistical analysis and so on, you wouldn't know there was any, you wouldn't spot anything wrong with that. And it did seem to me to be, it offended me that this was being essentially seemingly misinterpreted. I mean, clearly misinterpreted. Why it was misinterpreted is anyone's guess. But absolutely, I do find it embarrassing, and I think it's important that scientists, you know, try to stand up for what they see to be the truth, the evidence as best we can discern it.
Professor, I have one more question for you. You've done numerous papers that you've published on neonicotinoids. Could you just share with our listeners exactly how much clothianidin, for example, is enough to do significant harm to bumblebees?
Well, so that's a good question, because this question of dose comes up again and again. And one of the big criticisms of most of the studies that have shown harm to bees are criticized as having used unrealistically high doses of the pesticide. Now, we know that sort of field, if you look at the concentrations of neonics in pollen and nectar of treated crops, then generally speaking, they are very dilute, but then they're fantastically toxic compounds. So they're usually in the range of about one part per billion, sometimes up to 5 or 10 parts per billion in the pollen and nectar. And that's what the bees are generally consuming. It can sometimes be higher than that, but that would be fairly typical. And the big question is, what are bees actually exposed to in the field, and is that enough to do them harm? Well, this FERA study actually sheds a lot of light on that. So what the strongest relationship between colonies not doing very well and being exposed to pesticides was for the amount of clothianidin in the nectar stores of the colonies. And it ranged from between none that was detectable and 0.3 parts per billion. So actually, very little, very, very little, far less. If those bees had been feeding exclusively on a treated canola crop, they would have been getting perhaps an order of magnitude higher dose than the highest dose any of the nests in this study received. And yet, there's a really strong negative impact. So with a range of doses between none and 0.3 parts per billion, you go from nests that perform quite well to nests that perform, the ones that got 0.3 parts per billion or a little bit less, all perform really badly. So it's pretty clear that actually, you know, a fraction of the parts per billion is enough to do major harm to bumblebees. And we know full well that concentrations considerably higher than that are to be found out there in agricultural fields every year.
Thank you. Professor, thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to come on the show to provide a little bit of insight to our listeners about your latest analysis.
Always my pleasure.
Dr. Goulson, I would just like to express my appreciation for what you've done on behalf of all of those of us out here who are watching what's going on. We have varying degrees of scientific background, but we all have a very distinct feeling that we're being subjected to a massive and very carefully orchestrated snow job. And I would call upon other scientists as well to take a critical look at some of these things that are going on. We have a story that's going on right now about a study that was released by the University of Maryland and is being interpreted as a study showing that imidacloprid is safe for bees when it shows nothing of the sort. So we're on the receiving end of a very carefully managed message, and your voice is refreshing, and I thank you.
My pleasure. I'll carry on as long as I'm able.
Won't we all?
He's so amazing, isn't he, Tom?
Yes, he certainly is. He's a refreshing voice.
You know, in regards to what you were talking about with that paper, I just want to share this with our listeners. Now, the study, it was called Assessment of Chronic Sublethal Effects of Imidacloprid on Honeybee Colony Health, which was published in PLOS on March 18th of 2015, but was reported in the media as, quote, study finds imidacloprid safe for honeybees at realistic exposure levels. Now, for those of you that would like to see that link, you can visit http://entomologytoday.org. Now, my question is, Tom, how is this even possible?
You mean the changes in the titles, or I'm not sure I understand.
I don't understand how they can take a study that has been published and then spin it to state something that is completely opposite.
Well, it's interesting. I was listening to Dr. Goulson and thinking of my experience with these issues, and we've seen a recurring strain of these kinds of misrepresentations and misconstructions of the science. The industry says that they want the decisions to be based on science. What they don't tell you is that they want that science to either be their science or science that they have misreported. And sometimes that takes place at the scientist level. The scientists do the wrong thing. Sometimes it takes place between the scientists and the media, because the corporations have a great degree of control over the media, and I don't know exactly how it works, but my guess would be that they take a study like this and they assign it to a few of their employees who call their editorial contacts and say, here's an interesting story, and they feed them a headline, and they may even feed them a story, and that's appealing to the publication, because they don't have to put much work into it and they don't have to exercise much critical judgment. So it appears in the case in Great Britain that it was the scientist or scientists who either were incompetent or corrupt. In the case of the Maryland study, it's not clear just where this was misconstrued. There are some suggestions that it's something that has been managed by the chemical industry. It was done in 2009 to 2011 and wasn't published until 3 days before the hearing before the Maryland legislature on limitations to the neonicotinoids. Now, was that engineered to occur, or are they just lucky? I think our listeners can be the judge. There's one more, though, that goes back even further, and that's the infamous Cutler-Dupree study, which was the critical ingredient in the approval, the conditional registration for clothianidin, the most widely used of the neonicotinoids. And what they did, the Cutler-Dupree study was the condition upon which conditional registration was granted. And it was not completed until years after the date that it was due. But what they did was they put four colonies of bees on 2.5 acres that had been planted to treated canola, treated with clothianidin. And then they concluded that there was no problem with bees and the clothianidin because there was no harm done to the colonies. They were only there, I think, for 3 weeks. But the reality is that 2.5 acres represented 0.0008 of the bees' total foraging area. So a tiny, tiny fraction of their foraging area. And yet what the study found was that the clothianidin showed up in the bees and in the hive. That's the key piece of data, and it's been completely ignored and continues to be ignored. The fact that the bees pick that clothianidin up at all from that small planting is an indication of how dangerous this chemical really is. And that was misreported, and it's just another example of how this science has been manipulated.
Tom, joining us right now is Mr. Graham White, who's calling in from Scotland. So good evening, Graham, and thanks for calling in.
Oh, good evening, June. It was fantastic to hear Dave Goulson unleash the power of his Miltonic mind again. He's about the only honest pesticide scientist that I know of. Everybody else seems to have been bought, paid for, schmoozed, corrupted, or whatever, and he really does a great job.
Graham, what is your take on this whole controversy?
Well, I think I said in the last time we spoke that the industry and the regulatory agencies in both Britain and America, we tend to think of them as separate, but in fact, they're not separate at all. That there is no independent science in the universities. It's the only people funding any research on bees. It's not the governments, it's the industry. And the industry, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And for this appalling study from Great Britain, the one that Dave Goulson was talking about, the woman who carried that out, Dr. Helen Thompson, had to, you know, well, it was everybody else who was a scientist and looked at what she had done. What she did was she inadvertently proved that it's impossible to find any part of the south of England where you can have a neonicotinoid-free control colony. She had a bunch of colonies which were exposed to neonics, and then there were supposed to be ones which were clear of neonics, had no exposure at all, and then the whole point of the study was to compare the two. But in fact, all of the control colonies were hopelessly contaminated with neonicotinoids. So what she inadvertently proved was that the entire area of the south of England is saturated, drenched, contaminated with neonicotinoids, even when there are apparently no crops nearby. So it's impossible to actually carry out an experiment in the south of England now. And what did she do? Everybody in the know, everyone who's a scientist who looked at that study knew it was a complete disaster, a vast waste of money, and she immediately jumped ship and was given her reward. She was hired at a massive salary by Syngenta, the company who produced neonicotinoids. And when she went to Syngenta, she was following Dr. Peter Campbell. She left the government agency, FERA, the Environment and Research Agency, and she was following Dr. Peter Campbell, who'd been the head of the government Environmental Research Agency about 15 years ago. And when he left 15 years ago, he was rapidly followed by all the members of staff who'd worked for this government agency are now working for Syngenta. So the interpenetration between Bayer, Syngenta, Monsanto, Dow, and all of the so-called government regulators on both sides of the Atlantic. It's complete symbiosis. You know, the people know that if they do the right thing and say the right thing and produce the right results, they get a nice big fat salary working for Syngenta Bayer, massively more than they could even get in government employment. It's just utterly corrupt from beginning to end. It really is. So now we're in the stage where the science has proved, as Dave Goulson pointed out, it's proved again and again and again that you cannot have, 0.3 parts per billion is an infinitesimally small amount. That's about a third of a teaspoon of poison in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. And that's everywhere now. So any bees in the UK are being exposed to that, whether they're on crops that have been treated or not. And what Dave Goulson was in effect pointing out is that there is no independent science. I mean, he's a very, very rare example. But everybody else can be manipulated, massaged, and the game we are now playing is pure public relations and propaganda. It's got nothing to do with science. The Maryland study is exactly the same as the British discredited study. It's playing with the figures, manipulating the language, and you can feed something to John Entine and the other pro-neonicotinoid lobby people who are paid to do that job. And all they're trying to do is introduce an element of doubt. That's all they're trying to do. And it makes one despair. It means we have to have complete reform of the entire system, and we're not going to get that for a generation, probably.
Well, Graham, there are a number of comments that are circulating all throughout social media on pretty much anything that is published by the scientific community as far as science that is not paid for by industry, but science that is peer-reviewed, published, and has been independently conducted. What is this something that is just happening here exclusively to America, or do you see that across the pond by you?
I think there is no such thing as independent science anymore. When they decided, the British government decided and went public about 6 years ago, and they said, we're going to get to the bottom of this bee business. And what they did was they created a fund of about $20 million, and they said they were going to dish that out to researchers in the UK, like Dave Goulson, to investigate the problem of bee deaths. And what did they do? The person they put in charge of that committee was seconded from Syngenta. His name's Dr. Peter Campbell. And the other people from the British Beekeepers Association that were on that committee were all people who had been pro the neonicotinoids, you know, view. They just didn't believe neonics were a problem. And virtually not a penny of that money went to anybody who said he was prepared to look at neonicotinoids. All of that $20 million went to people who knew how to play the game, who said, we're going to look at wildflowers, we're going to look at climate change, we're going to look at anything possible, as long as it never went near neonicotinoids.
None of it went to Dr. Goulson, did it?
None of it went to Dr. Goulson. Dr. Goulson, as far as I remember, applied for money to do his bumblebee study, and he was flatly refused because he mentioned the word neonicotinoids. And he and his students said, well, you know, we'll do it ourselves in our own time. And they are heroic for having done that. So there is no independent science. The science, the regulatory authorities are completely synonymous with the pesticide industry. They are the same people with different hats circulating through the same revolving door.
Anyway. Well, Graham, I just want to say thank you so much for calling in to the show, and you are more than welcome to call in. As well as, folks, if you would like to communicate your concerns or if you disagree with anything that the scientists have contributed, please, by all means, write to us. We would like to hear your comments, whether they're in support or against. But we are out of time. Tom, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Joan, and thank you, Graham, for calling in. It's always good to talk to you.
Well, I'm so in awe of what you and June do. You are keeping the flag flying for independent science and independent thought in a time of absolute evil. thanks for doing it.
You're very welcome.
I'm going to put on my cape and go home.
Okay.
And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. You can listen to the Neonicotinoid View each week as Tom and I continue discussing the impact of neonicotinoids on the environment. Have a great afternoon, everyone.